Welcome to the Latter Gay Stories Podcast, the show that features real people, real stories, and real talk. This is the intersection of sexuality and reality. Now, here's the voice of the show, Kyle Ashworth.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Latter Gay Stories Podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Ashworth, and we are excited to have you joining us today. If you are listening to an audio version of the podcast, we invite you to jump over to our video version through Facebook or YouTube, where you can catch a real-time chat of this very broadcast. All of our broadcasts, podcast episodes, are provided in both audio and video format. So if you are hanging out on Facebook or YouTube, we invite you to make a comment below and share your thoughts and feelings about this episode. And if you are catching us on an audio version through Stitcher, Google Play, Apple Podcast, or one of the others, we invite you to subscribe to the channel and catch every single episode and get the notification as soon as we release it. The Latter Gay Stories Podcast is your opportunity to understand the intersection of sexuality and reality, where it meets at LDS Street and LGBTQ Avenue. We again thank you for joining us on this episode and want to welcome, during this episode, to the broadcast, Chris Richards.
Hi, everybody. Great to be here today.
You excited for this?
I'm so excited.
So, Chris, you and I have been friends for a while.
It's been a while.
And I can't believe it's now, finally, your opportunity to jump into the podcast.
I know. Why wasn't I the first one to, like, jump in on this?
It's probably because we had to go all the way to Colorado to find you.
You know, that happens.
That's what you get for living outside of Zion.
I know. I'm on the wrong side of the mountains, dang it.
That's right.
Well, the right side. You never know.
You probably is the right. It's the right side.
It's the right side.
Colorado is pretty beautiful.
It's fantastic.
So, Chris, you've got a fascinating story. The reason why I thought, for sure, Chris, in this season of the podcast is mixed orientation marriage, mm-hmm. LDS,
yep.
All the things that typically ring all the bells in when it comes to LGBT, LDS relations, mm-hmm. Really are your world. So, and you're also pretty candid, so we could have a pretty candid discussion about your journey and where it's taken you. So again, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's start with the point where Chris realized that he's different, that there was something different about you as opposed to brothers, sisters, friends. Mm-hmm. When did that happen? At what point did you make that correlation?
Well, let's take you back to a bright sunny day in 1983.
This sounds like an introduction to the Book of Mormon musical.
That's right.
In Oop State, Colorado.
Well, after coming out 3 or so years ago, I started really having a lot of some of the memories of where I was different or, oh yeah, that's what that really meant, those kind of things. So there was really never, for me in a childhood, never like a defining moment that stuck out necessarily. It's just kind of like how you've always enjoyed eating oranges. It's just, you know, when did you enjoy eating oranges? It's just always been. But there are moments just throughout childhood where there are little inklings just outside of the general feeling of I feel different than a lot of the other people around me. Just having weird feelings when there were other guys around when I was, you know, 8, 9, 10, those kind of feelings. Just feeling generally, maybe I'm just a really shy guy, as a teenager, I never participated in any of the chats when it came to, you know, oogling girls or anything like that. And I thought, just look how freaking chivalrous I am, you know? I'm the guy opening all the doors and being nice and kind, and that could be the case. Maybe I am a nice guy, but it turns out I'm just a nice gay guy.
My mom sent me a picture of me standing next to the Hogle Zoo lion in a mesh black crop top, doing something weird. She's like, I should have known that.
Yeah.
Yeah, just one of those, if you look back, maybe you can find all the signs.
I think they were there inside. But I was really careful to make sure I looked the same and walked the same and sat the same and did everything the same as all the other guys out there. So, you know, things like tank tops, I recognize that might be something that was different. And so I never wore tank tops. Still kind of have a hard time doing things like that. So I don't really, in growing up in the church, there was never a place or a time or a mechanism to let alone explore, but not even to discuss why you're different or what things mean. And so I just always felt different. I always felt sad, kind of on the outside.
What was your family dynamic like? Is your family recognizing some of those differences? Were you treated differently because of that? Did you recognize that with your family?
That one's a little bit harder to pin down. I'm the oldest of 12 kids. So there's me and then five sisters. So that's why my grandma thinks I'm gay, is because I had five sisters and no brothers. But I tell her it didn't work like that. And so I was always on the outside there too. And so there's just all these little experiences throughout my life. Homeschooled for a little while. That totally makes you on the outside from other people in your ward. A little more quiet, a little more shy, a little more reserved. I was a really big teenager. And so that also adds to a lot of stuff.
What do you mean by that? Shame? Exclusion? Seclusion? What did weight have to do with?
It's just that another factor that didn't make me, or didn't easily help me fit in. Gotcha. With the other guys in a lot of the quorums growing up. And yeah, there's tons of shame in that. You know, you're big and it's embarrassing. And so I think really when it started hitting home that things were very different, or when I started categorizing why it was different, it was on my mission. Being around all of the missionaries in the MTC Center, or the MTC, that helps out. Being one-on-one with a guy, having that kind of very close relationship where you're not exactly dating, but you're not exactly not dating.
It's a really good point.
Right?
Hugs at night, mm-hmm. I love you elders at night, all of the things that are...
There's a lot of joking around very intimate things. There's a lot of just, you know, walking around in underwear or no shirts. And I didn't go to college before the mission, so I never really experienced any kind of dorm-type life. So that starts peaking a few things. But my experience with the church was really good at defining those kind of feelings as either temporary. I never came out before my mission to any bishops. That was afterwards when I wanted to go to a temple open house, and I had to tell them I was looking at, you know, gay pornography every now and again. But before that, it was just, it'll pass. It's, you know, it was framed more like a perversion or a kink or something that you just kind of needed to work through.
You'll grow out of it.
You'll grow out of it eventually, yeah.
And a lot of the message in the church at the time was mission, marriage, children. Mm-hmm. You just, mm-hmm. you get to the point, and we'll get into this as part of your story, but you just, you need to refocus, mm-hmm. Put off all of these natural tendencies, yeah. The natural man, and then just move on and start focusing on things like, so you've already been through your mission, so now it's time to get married, and,
yeah,
and then
exactly.
Children will start making all this go away.
Yeah.
We'll get to that point. So we're at the mission. You're paying full attention to all the other elders.
Yeah, I am.
No access to gay pornography at that point. So you've only got your companions walking around. What's going on in your head? Are you putting all that together at that point, saying I'm for sure gay, or is this just something that's like there's something really weird going on?
It's more just a weird thing. I really hadn't connected all of these dots yet. And I think that in growing up in a large family and then growing up in a church where everything is so laid out, there's not a lot of chance to discover who you are as an individual. There's not a lot of room for that. And so for a lot of it, you just kind of follow the path that your dad and your uncles and other brothers and for generations have followed. And you never really have a chance to discover any of these things. There were several times on my mission where I did meet up with other gay elders. Everybody was so in the closet, but or I would meet with another gay couple, you know, tracting or whatnot. And you felt something there. And never at these times did I ever say, you know what, I think I'd like to, I think I'd like to get naked with them or something. It was more like if I were a little baby goose raised by ducks, right? And you see these other geese and you feel that there's more connection there. You're like them, but you're a duck. So you kind of like, that's weird. You know, maybe I ate something funny. And so that's most of the vibe. Every time I felt the feelings that in other situations I would have been like, I am probably gay. It's more just this unspoken mystical connection.
I think that's a great analogy. It's I get it. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of listeners who are listening to this podcast or watching this podcast, may find that idea that you are still not correlating the fact that you're gay a little weird, but it's more common than most people think. Because I think for a number of reasons. One is that it's not that we wake up in the morning saying, I want to be gay.
Right.
So you're always trying to put that off anyway, mm-hmm. and always burying that or putting it in a box and smashing the box and not exactly. paying attention to the box. So I get it. I completely understand why that was your method. So you come home from your mission.
Mm-hmm.
Where does your life go from there?
So it went...
Because now you have free reign.
Oh, now I have free reign that, right?
You got the oyster now.
Yeah. I do. So I had full access to, a lot of exploration, a lot of discovery, and I didn't do anything because I still thought and felt I was straight. Because I grew up in Arizona, but it was kind of like another more conservative, purist mecca of the Mormon culture. And so there's, again, no more chance for discovery, but I had the path already laid out for me in my brain for the last 21 years, high school, mission, marriage. And I'd always been kind of a quiet, shyer guy, didn't have a large group of friends, and so there wasn't another time to date. I didn't do any dating, really. So when I got back, there was still that's where some of the homosexual pornography came into play. But still, even then, it never occurred to me that because I enjoyed looking at gay pornography or the dudes in straight porn, that meant anything outside of just, oh, I shouldn't be doing this.
It was just a fetish that just made it work.
Just fetish, yeah. Just, you know, sometimes people like to watch people getting strapped up. And so that's kind of what I rationalized, justified, or explained what those feelings were. And then one night, I was a third wheel with my best friend and his girlfriend. And there was another girl who was a third wheel with her friend. And we all went ice skating. And me and this girl named Kate, we just really hit it off. But for me, it was just, there was like a kinship. And we started dating after that. And we went to Weezer and saw Signs. And just after that ice skating night, she pushed me over and we had lots of fun jokes. And we just dated and really hadn't been apart since then until we got married just a few months later. It was really, really quick.
In true Mormon BYU fashion.
True Mormon. Oh, man, we were. If you look back at the whole calendar of how we did stuff and how I did my life up until 3 years ago, I was following the book. I was making my parents really happy and proud. So
yeah, world mm-hmm. record BYU engagement. Mm-hmm. After a lengthy courtship of 2.5 weeks, you were married to Kate.
Exactly. I think we met in October and were married in November. That kind of crazy speed. But we got along so well. Jokes were, you know, we had the same taste in movies and music and jokes and.
Which are all the things you look for in a relationship anyway.
Right, yeah. They were all solid things.
Yeah.
But this is only in hindsight, which is kind of unfair, I think. Hindsight realizations can be so clouded by so many different things. So when I talk or try to tell stories, I don't like to come back to those. You know, in hindsight, I should have seen, or in hindsight, this is what this meant. But since coming out, what really made us work, because we were married for 15 some odd years, and we had such a strong relationship, and we had 4 kids together, and our relationship was always so much healthier, so much vibrant, than any of our other friends. And I guess hindsight, now that I said all that, in hindsight, really what that was is it was because it was firm foundation in like really good friends. And now that I've dived into the gay culture, really what we represented was kind of the classic gay dude and his straight girl best friend kind of relationship. And that's what made it work before for me. That's how it was, that's how I was able to make it work.
Do you think Kate felt a disconnect in that relationship in terms of, and maybe this is a little earlier for that question, mm-hmm. but there was a friendship. Was there a did either of you recognize that the relationship was so built on the friendship and maybe not on connection? Or what was it just mm-hmm. working and symbiotic and not either of you paying attention to that?
I think that's perhaps the undercurrent of what made things work. She didn't ever, you know, we've had lots of discussions about this since. She never felt it like that. She felt that there was, you know, an emotional, logical, sexual connection all across the board for both of us, because that's exactly what she felt. And part of that is that I worked really hard to be a good husband and a good everything to the marriage. So even when things, you know, on the sexual side weren't always there, but also I've only ever been with her at that point, so I never know if they were or were not there. I didn't know what there was. I still worked really hard to make things happen.
So you didn't discuss any of your sexuality with her prior to getting married.
Correct. Yeah. We went into it with some hetero expectations.
Explain that. What does that mean?
That,
especially in terms of Mormonism.
Okay. So there are a surprising amount of mixed orientation marriages where, you know, the couple goes together knowing that one of the other couple is homosexual. And they try to make it work because that's what we've been promised works in the long run. And I did, like I mentioned, talk with a bishop once and told him about the gay porn. And he's like, well, you need to get married to a good, solid Mormon girl and those kind of things will go away. Once you start having straight sex and start having, you know, this straight family and this straight life, everything else will follow suit. So that's what I went into the marriage really firmly believing. Because at that point, and really throughout most of the marriage and even most of the coming out, I hated the idea of being gay. And I think that kind of thing, you feel it growing up, you feel it, but it's hard to articulate.
Did you feel like you were failing or that you weren't doing enough because those feelings still existed? Did you feel like it was fraudulent, what you had been sold? Because, I mean, obviously, that's an emotional cord there.
Yeah.
Something triggers that emotion. What is triggering those feelings of, like, just take you back to that moment, like, gosh, this is what I'm feeling right now as I think about that whole experience.
That's a hard one. I think maybe that's some of the stuff I haven't really unpacked fully. It's always at the surface. You can feel it. You know, you can see the ebbs and flows, but it's just still something that's still hard. Even 3 years after coming out.
I think that's honest and fair. At what point did you come out? What was that experience that said, it's time to be honest about who and what I am?
Yeah. So this is the fun stuff. We'll get no more of the other stuff.
Well, let's dig ourselves out of the hole.
Okay,
a little bit.
Thank you. So I have backstories a little bit. I have always had a hard time buying into a lot of the churches, just a lot of religion. it doesn't make sense to me. And it was hard for me to go on a mission and to pitch these ideas to people and then coming home. So 10 years ago, I told Kate, I have some serious doubts. I don't believe this and that, and I, you know, not to go into all of that pieces of it. And so I had been kind of working my way out for a while. And then 4 years ago or so, Kate noticed I was having a really bad day, and we had lots of chats at this point. This was right after 2015, November, where I just kind of had enough, and I text my bishop and I said, is this real, or is this what those bad antis there are trying to make me feel bad? And he's like, nope, this is real. And I'm like, well, fuck, I'm out of here then. So I still went to church because I have four kids, and it's a judgy type environment, and I didn't want anyone judging Kate or my kids. And so we still went to church, but I don't remember what I was doing. And up until this point, leaving, I never looked at any anti. I never read anything. I didn't even know who John DeLynn was until I had stopped going to church, because I wanted leaving the church to be like a pure, kind of beautiful experience, unmuddled by anger.
But on your terms.
On my terms, right. I didn't want to have to read anything or see anything or people think that I read and saw, or just that I wanted to drink or whatever. So it's one thing leads to the next, and I had found the transcripts for Jeremy Rennell's excommunication, which led me to the CS letter, which I read 3 pages of it, and it broke me down. It just tore me apart. And so I was just really, really, really sad. And so I left to go for a run or something. And so Kate got on my computer to see kind of, she's trying to figure out what made me so sad. And she saw the letter, the CS letter, started reading it. And she's like, I wish it was just porn and not CS letter, because we could have dealt with that. So then she read it, and like a week later, she was done as well. I mean, she had had a lot of issues in the past. The November policy was pretty hard on her too. She'd been grappling with how to fit all of her gay friends into this mix and already. So she had a lot of issues. So we left, and we left in June of 16. And then November of that year, we were finishing off a bottle of wine. And so we had a lot of time to kind of, you know, once you leave the church, some other things start slipping in, and you start wondering what other pieces of life you didn't experience. And so she knew that she was my first. I think she was probably my fourth date ever with anybody. First handhold, first girlfriend, first kiss. So in her mind at that point, she was wondering, you know, maybe he missed out. So she's like, is there anything else that you wish that you were doing? We're just kind of having a little drunken, fun hypothetical discussion.
It's the rosé talking.
It's the rosé. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was a Melbourne, you know, whatever. And I don't really remember how it all came out, but I think, and then I said, I think I'm bi.
Because you don't remember much of the night, let's be
honest. I don't remember much of the night. I do remember saying, I think I'm bi. And because I identified bi for several months, because you have to wrap your wife and your family into this. You have to come up with some kind of explanation how they freaking fit into it. So that's how I came out. That was the first part. But up until then, I do remember, you know, as I'm rambling, I'm starting to remember little bits and pieces. And there were times where I was like, if I do come out, and again, now that I'm starting to ramble, I'm remembering some of the feelings. It's been a long time since I've had to kind of rehash these things.
And not everybody's putting you in front of cameras and microphones.
I know, there's some lights here and a furniture rearrange and a monkey on the couch. And so I do remember looking in the mirror probably just a few weeks or a month before that and saying, I'm gay. And that was so weird feeling that come out and the taste of those words and how thrilling they were to say. But also, you know, it was terrifying. And then I probably like broke something or got really angry. Went for another run. Man, gotta burn it out somewhere. But you know what? Even though my theological leanings do not lean towards God, but I feel like I'm so blessed having Kate in my life, having that kind of cosmic connection with someone. Because that night, she's like, let's open the marriage, download Grindr. You need to have these experiences.
So she was proactive.
Yeah. So we signed up for Grindr together, just like a classic fag and hag kind of scenario. We looked through the guys. She helped me take some pictures. I just felt so much love and so much support. It was overwhelming. And I think I was on Grindr till like 6 in the morning.
It's amazing. Like, I've never heard this part of the story.
Yeah. I thought I told you this part. And I think then a week later, maybe 10 days later, I met up with some guy in the grossest possible way. But for me, I thought that's my first experience with a guy. It should be in the back room of some porn house in like the little stalls.
Sounds like you pretty much got it.
I mean, as far as like, I love to collect these little weird experiences, it was just kind of perfect. It was, it was the first time I like held a guy's hand and kissed and just was, and I felt so alive. And even though the experience was, you know, or the environment was kind of a little bit grungy, but it was at that point I was like, oh shit, this might be more than just a preference for redheads.
So I think the part of this, because what you just talked about is going to be really uncomfortable for a lot of people who listen to this, mainly because everything in Mormonism taught mm-hmm. them that's so taboo. That whole idea, especially, I mean, you're married. You're married. Essentially, you and your wife have now opened up that mm-hmm. relationship. So that's the first taboo mark.
Yep.
The second taboo mark is there's a variation in sexuality. So you're no longer this straight relationship. So your story is much different than the typical Mormon story, because you've already left the church.
Yep.
You've distanced yourself from a lot of those rules and restrictions. Mm-hmm. So that's given you the freedom. But then also the traditional boundaries in marriage have been opened up as well. So I think that'll feel very foreign, but it's an interesting part of your story, mm-hmm. and a very familiar part of other people's stories.
Sure.
So I think that's very worthy of talking about, and I appreciate the honesty there.
I was just saying, I know that it's in talking with other gay Mormon dads who, you know, when I first started some of the affirmation groups, I told them how we're making this work, and it was really scary. The idea of doing that was really scary. Or they were still latched onto a lot of some of the old theologies or relationship structures. And I do recognize that I got a sweet slice of heaven.
In Kate.
Yeah, with Kate and with everything, just how it lined up just nicely. And even though I was able to go out and explore, it did not come without some major costs.
And so the point that I was going to make there too, the other part of this is that those feelings that you were feeling, you brought it up saying it wasn't just like this fetish hook to a redhead. It was maybe for the first time you felt authentic.
Yeah.
And that connection was real.
Yeah.
And that's an important part that I hope the listeners understand. When we talk about coming out and when we talk about what authenticity looks like and what honesty feels like, I think what you just described is a very good example of what that feels, looks, and acts like. It is now, for the first time, a connection.
Yeah.
Something that you hadn't had before, even though, I mean, you may have made it to the 40-yard line, but now it's end zone and spike the ball and, knocked it out of the park completely.
That's a lot of sports references that I...
Oh, yeah.
I don't get that.
You're not that far.
I'm...
Okay, I get you.
I'm not a sports gay.
So it's like 10,000 sequins on a crocheted.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah, you get it.
That's the, there you go.
Okay.
I don't get that either. But yeah, it was a very interesting experience for me. Something I've never had in my life.
Where'd you go from there? Is there something that happened different in your marriage? Did the structure of the marriage mm-hmm. change? Where did the path go from? Grungy, redheaded hookup off Grindr.
Dirty. So at that point, we were still running with the play. See, look at that. This is sports reference.
Gotcha.
10 points for me. Go sports team. So I was still running with the idea that I was bi. Again, that made a lot of sense. And that's what I wanted to be. I didn't want to be gay and have to disrupt the lives of these five other people. So we started talking about polyamory, where we still had, Kate and I were still primary partners, but yet we had some side hustles here and there, whatever. And that worked out great until I had my first real gay boyfriend. And then I started realizing that I was a super big slut. It was a lot of exploration, a lot of experimentation, trying to figure stuff out. And here I was, mid-30s, really living like a college kid straight out of hell. And so up until that point, all this kind of random safe sex and safe exploration was great. But before I settled down on this guy for a while, the contact with the gay world satisfied a lot. But I started wanting and needing more. And that's when things really started changing, where I started realizing that a polyamorous scenario wasn't going to work. And maybe even a scenario where I was married wasn't going to work anymore, because that started to be inauthentic. So kind of the pendulum swung from being so authentic and just so high, it's such on a high all the time, I started having to rehide things again. And that was really scary. And I didn't want to go back inside another closet, just since I just got out of a really big one. And so that's where things were about a year ago, when I found this really cool connection with a guy. And that's where Kate and I started having a lot of really, really tough discussions. And so since then, we've separated. We're still in the same household. We're giving that a shot. I mean, if the weeds can do it, come on.
That's right.
Come on, guys.
Not on 640 Colorado acres yet.
But. No, we're still in 3,000 square feet, so it's a little bit more difficult. But we have separated rooms. She's in the basement because she likes it nice and cold and dark. And we started trying to live separate lives. And it's been working out pretty good. But again, not without costs and not without nuance and difficulties. But that's kind of where we're at now. I still struggle quite a bit. It's fortuitous that we decided to have this conversation now and not 6 months ago, or even 60 days ago. Would have been a very different discussion. It would have just been storytelling. And I can't even pinpoint any specific kind of moment where things changed for me, but finally, I'm sort of starting to see the idea of being cool with being gay, with being who I am. And I don't know, you may be able to feel a different, because I feel different than when we met 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. Even then, I did not like it. I just wanted to be around other gay Mormon dads who understood what I was going through, who understood like the hardship part. But I think I can imagine myself moving forward. And sometimes it's hard because Kate and I are really good friends and we have a really good dynamic with the whole family. And it often feels like I'm being very selfish, having to, you know, disrupt the lives of my beautiful kids and this beautiful Kate just so I could go have this relationship or this portion. And it's been such a struggle to realize that that's a pretty big thing, having those connections authentically.
And it's something that I will wager 100% of the men in our situation struggle with that very topic.
Yeah.
The element of Mormonism adds to that, where there is such a focus put on, you use the word selfishness, and I think that's the appropriate word, where the church teaches us that all these things that you're doing, those are selfish. Because the structure of Mormonism is to teach that this is a familial unit. Everything you do as a family. Now you running off and doing what makes Chris happy is the things just for Chris.
Yeah, and that's not what you're supposed to do.
And you leave four children and a wife in as collateral damage to your escapade.
Yeah.
So I think many, many men who are listening to this, and women as well, on the opposite side of this spectrum, are saying, I get it.
Yeah.
That they will remain closeted because of that idea of not being selfish, or that feeling that I am becoming too selfish.
Yeah.
Deep, tough stuff.
Yeah.
What's your advice to someone like that listening who feels that? What got you out of that slump?
Like with any outcome, with any situation, there's never just one thing. It's 100 different causes. And that's kind of where it is for me. It's just 100 different things. And we can talk about all of the ancillary issues or the ancillary factors, like a really cool Kate and very understanding parents, an award that left me alone, and friends and all that kind of thing, but all of those things are fleeting. They're going to go away, and they have gone away for the most part, but for me, it was to realize that I can still love my children, I can still have all the other relationships that I had before, and they don't have to change. Like real, the core of what all of those things were don't have to change. And it was facing that fear that things would change and that I would totally fuck my kids up and that they're gonna go off and like do drugs and get pregnant and stuff if I did these things. But it took a long time to see that I can come out, I can introduce guys to my kids, and seeing them flourish, seeing them love to see me happy. And then to go back to that, you know, that guy 3 years ago who looked in the mirror and was disgusted when he said, I think you're gay. Realizing that it's a beautiful thing. And that I sort of deserve to feel genuinely happy. So I do know that it's scary. I know that, you know, I wish there weren't other people in our situations where you have to juggle this. Well, if I was gay, I wouldn't have this great relationship, or I wouldn't have these amazing children. I wouldn't have this experience. And yeah, that's been fantastic. I've always wanted to be a dad. I've always wanted that relationship with small people, Mielden. And yeah, I may not have had the same exact one if I had a few other situations happen before now. But there is a light on the other side of it. It's not going to be what we think it's going to be. But I had to finally realize that I am deserving of authentic connection, of a real, real love.
I often say the threefold purpose of the podcast is to help people see that they're not alone, they're not broken, and that their best days are ahead. Can you identify with any of those?
Hope so. Yes. And uh-huh. No, yeah. There was a point in my life where I helped young kids who had drug addictions and saw some people at their very worst. It was disgusting and it was just so sad. But you do have to hit a rock bottom. And it is possible to see that there is something outside of it. And that even though these kids have been clean for a while, they always feel broken. And I still feel broken quite often, but it's not as painful anymore. And I can see future selves. So a lot of it's been a lot of mindset games. So as opposed to me thinking of being in this junky apartment all alone, crying over, ramen, I imagine myself with a man that I love, sitting next to Kate, watching somebody walk down an aisle, or watching somebody graduate from college, where we're still together. And I think those little mind, that perception changes, that's the big one for me. So those days are looking cooler ahead.
And they're coming into focus.
Yeah.
It's a reality.
Mm-hmm.
Often when we talk about the hypothetical life on the other side of the aisle, everything is a fantasy.
Yeah.
It's all imagined because we A, have no experience in that world, and B, our stories are similar enough that we didn't ever want to breach that. We were doing nothing to cross over that line. And so you just sat back and imagined what life could be like, and now you're at the helm. You're directing your own ship.
Exactly.
And you have that opportunity. You talked about earlier in the podcast support from family.
Mm-hmm.
How did that support come? What is it that your family is doing that you felt was supportive and beneficial to you?
Well, for me, their support really came in the role of omission. They didn't tell me I was going to hell. They didn't tell me I was doing anything bad. So, from my experience with talking with a lot of gay guys and LGBT people in general, is that when they come out to their parents, a lot of their parents' issues are, well, now I'll never have grandkids and I'll never have this. And they, as parents, we imagine this grand scheme for our children. And so that's been a lot of when people come out, typically their parents' dreams of their child's life are dashed. So for me, I never really got a lot of the typical backlash because I'd already married in the temple, I already served a mission, and I already gave them a crap ton of kids, grandkids. And all of my kids are awesome, so this is like even better. So they never really had any pushback. And that's what I really appreciated, is just that they kind of let me be. They gave me some space. My dad is a bishop of his ward, and I know that these things are very difficult for him and for my mom. And to their credit, they worked really hard to try to understand. What's his first name? Christofferson's book?
Tom.
Tom, thank you.
That We May Be One.
Yeah. Yes, that's the one.
Available at Deseret Book.
Jeez. Money, money, money.
The podcast gets no residual
benefits but it could,
from the book.
If you know where to go.
Tom, thank you.
So they picked up his book and they read it. And they've been trying to make things work in their own mind. And so it's been really slow. We don't have a lot of conversations, which is fine. I can have cool conversations with other people. But they try really hard. And I think that's what makes the difference for me. So I don't feel... So they kind of give me a neutral ground to make my own mistakes.
What about other friends? Have you seen a shift in social circles? I mean, you experienced that, I'm sure. We all did.
Mm-hmm.
When there was a transition of faith and when you leave the safety of the Mormon circle.
Yeah.
So there's always a shift in friends and community support. What happened with your circle of friends after coming out and that experience?
Well, it was easy because after leaving the church, you lose about 90% of the friends that were really close to you in the church. Because the church does a lot of things great, but they keep you really busy. And so that means that sometimes you have friends of convenience. And so I had to shed a lot of friends of convenience when I left the church. So I already lost a lot of friends just by leaving.
Sure, yeah.
So that cleaned house quite a bit. And then coming out, cleaned house a little bit more. But what I discovered is that the friends that I've made post-coming out and post-coming out are so much, the friendships are so much more richer. This authenticity attracts such a unique crowd. And since then, I've found these people just out of the woodwork, and all over the country. And they, my own siblings do not travel to visit me in Colorado. And that's probably a lot of other issues, but these friends that I've made post leaving and post this authentic life have, you know, within a year have come out and visited 3 or 4 times. Because it's so true and it's so real. It's not a friendship of convenience. And I just never have had friends of this caliber. And it's been amazing once you kind of let go of who you think you are, who you think you want to be, who you think other people want to see.
The expectation.
It's gone. It's so freeing. People see that. And they are attracted to that before they are attracted to anything else. So the friendships after leaving have been amazing. And these are all mostly straight people too, you know, which, you know, is could be improved, but I still love straight people.
If you expand your friendship pool to include some more gay people, you might not be single, Chris.
Well, I try.
We all do.
Well, yeah, the friends have been amazing.
Advice to parents who have a son or daughter in this situation, married. Mm-hmm. Many parents have reached out to me saying, I think my son is, or I'm pretty confident my daughter.
Yeah.
What advice would you have for parents? Because you have a unique situation of being on both sides of this topic. You're a dad.
I am a dad.
And you also are a gay dad.
Yeah, that's right.
Who had to come out and had to have that conversation. So what advice would you give to parents who are looking at this from the outside in, not knowing how to tread or where to walk?
That's an interesting question at this time because I have a daughter who just came out. She's also been wearing suits and stuff to school functions way before I came out, so it's not something too surprising. But that's been really fun sharing this experience with her. Because we can share it so authentically. I think one of the major things that would be awesome if parents can see their children outside of their own expectations for that child. So if you think, you know, if you think a son or daughter is gay or lesbian, it's time to start realizing it's their life. I go back and forth on parents coming in and being pretty proactive and say, I think that this is that, or I think that you're this, or, you know, that fishnet tank top, you know, that's,
your dad doesn't. I swear to you, my mother must have bought it for me because I wouldn't have picked it out. Or it was on a blue light special at Kmart.
Yeah.
So we were compelled by the sale.
Mm-hmm. Well, either way, been fabulous. I can give you the advice on how I've been kind of navigating my daughter's own adventure and discovering ways in which she feels comfortable communicating. And we've been working on this for a good year because she's not one to come and talk. I knew there was something on her mind. And there were a couple of times where I did kind of a, what's going on with you kind of scenario. But we started realizing that she communicates very differently than the other three kids.
Surprise.
I know, right? That's weird. And I think it works because I see another swan. And so I'm able to, you know, feel things that she might be feeling. And so discovering ways in which they communicate, listening. You know, that's kind of a pretty cliche, but really listening rather than hoping or trying to interpret, just let it happen.
Advice to, and I know this is probably not the road you want to go down, but I think it's important for this podcast. Advice to church leaders who are listening to this podcast, who will look at your story and say, wow, we could have rescued him. Mm-hmm. Or we could have stepped in. What is your advice to those church leaders who look at your story and say, oh, we failed, Chris, at some point?
my heart goes out to people who think they failed other people like that. I think that's the first step, is changing the paradigm that it's a failure or a success story. It's just a story. We got to remove meaning from things like that. A recent experience. I got some balls and posted about it. And one of the very first comments was from a really, really good guy, a member. I guess he's in the stake presidency now, but he was a member of the Bishop Brick when I had left the church. He's just a really, really kind guy. But in his post, he was in his reply, he was a little bit defensive. So I had posted something like, you know, I was promised that I would be straight if I got married and did everything right. And he's like, I'm very surprised by that. I can't imagine a bishop telling you anything like that. And when I left, also, the bishop came over and he said, okay, well, what policies, you know, what were you offended and all this kind of stuff. And what I've been talking with my dad about, and what I would really like to counsel, if I could give some advice to these well-intended, hard-working, the people who do a lot of good, is to see past the policies, see past the doctrine, see past the offense, see past all the other surface-level stuff, and see the real pain that these other human beings are having. We see them as an object, as an inconvenience, as a blight on their reports. But I think if a bishop could see that someone is not just wanting to drink coffee or go and sin, but they see the pain, and they understand, if they could understand the hours of heartache it takes to leave the church, and the pain and the trauma of dragging yourself out of that, recreating yourself after that, they could connect with someone on a very human level, that's what would make the biggest difference. I might have stayed had somebody reached out and treated me like that.
I seem to find this over and over again, that when you put the seal of living reality on this topic by finding someone, whether it's your son, daughter, or someone close to you who experiences or is impacted by the topic, by an LGBTQ topic, then that's when the change happens. Yeah. That's when a leader starts paying attention to it. I think that's one of the greatest reasons why I continue to run the podcast, is sharing those stories and getting familiar with the experiences of other people, drawing into that where there's that new connection that church leaders, parents, friends, associates now start paying attention to this topic, because it's not just something that is in the newspaper or laughed about in a Christmas party at work or any of those other things. It's a real human. And when you connect that with someone that you love and someone that you care about, the whole dynamic changes.
Yeah.
And I think that goes along exactly with your advice to church leaders. Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up that we haven't talked about?
Whew, we did cover quite a bit.
We covered
some good times.
Yeah.
Some good times. You had mentioned there's a large contingent of your podcast that is still deeply in or trying to come out.
Yeah.
And those are real fears. Those are sort of valid fears. And some of them are real. I mean, they're coming out, if you're even without a family, is a life-changing experience. And for some people it is devastating. But it is, every moment is worth coming out and leaving, in being real and being authentic. And I know it's the same advice, but maybe people hear it more, and people hear it from different perspectives. And I had everything to lose coming out. I had everything. I thought I was going to lose my entire family, but I didn't.
You were promised that you would lose spiritual experiences, happiness, opportunity. Any of that true?
Nope. I've never been more happy. I've never been more in tune with who I am. I've also never been more professionally successful after leaving. And they all result from being authentic. All these connections from being authentic. I met, you know, you meet the person who meets the person who needs to hire you, and or who knows somebody who has a gay brother. This is the only way of truly living is fucking the fear, walking out, and tasting that real flavor.
You've got a fascinating story. I think the beauty of your story and so many like it is that it's still being written.
It is.
And I knew you 2 years ago, not the same Chris. And that's the awesome part. And in 2 years, we progress even further. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of like that coming out experience where you come out once. That first coming out is the one that you never get to go back in again.
Yeah.
So you come out to never go back in that closet. And then you come out again and again and again and again to all the different people in our lives. But the beauty of the coming out is that it also is a letting in. It's allowing people to come into our lives. And I think we discussed that really well in terms of that's what authenticity and honesty feels like. When we allow people to come into our lives and we invite them in on our terms and mm-hmm. allow them to see us for who and what we are. It strips that expectation away and allows us to be exactly who we are.
Yeah.
With or without alcohol.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Again, thank you for giving us a few minutes of your time.
Absolutely.
And, if you have questions for Chris and you're following along on the video version through Facebook or YouTube, we invite you to leave a question, your thoughts or comments about this episode. Mixed orientation marriages. The topic of mixed orientation marriages is always tough. And it's one of those topics that we really, really need to spend some more time on. And in some of the upcoming episodes of this season at Latter Gay Stories, we will sit down with couples who have went through this as well and share that perspective from both the straight and non-straight spouse. The Latter Gay Stories podcast is your opportunity, as we have discussed, to inspect and better understand the intersection of sexuality and reality, where it meets in everyday life, where real people's experiences and stories are given as an example and an opportunity to learn from. We thank you for joining us for this hour of the Latter Gay Stories podcast and invite you to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to the audio version, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, through Google Play or one of the other podcast providers. We invite you to subscribe and catch all the new episodes as they will be sent right to your devices as soon as we publish them. You can also support the Latter Gay Story podcast by making a financial donation. You can log on to our website at lattergaystories.org and click on the donate link. Or if you're Venmo friendly, feel free to send us over a donation at Latter Gay Stories. Again, the Latter Gay Stories podcast is your opportunity to understand the experiences of other people, but most importantly, it is your opportunity to continue writing your Latter Gay Story.
This episode is a production of Latter Gay Stories. We are always looking for new friends. Give us a like on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at Latter Gay Stories. The podcast is made possible because of generous donors like you. Make a donation now by texting the word STORIES to 77948. Your donation gives us the ability to build bigger bridges by producing more Latter Gay Stories. Want more? Find this episode and others online at lattergaystories.org.